Don't forget your sunblock.
And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and with me is Phil Conlon.
Hi, yeah, good afternoon, Phil.
Today we're going to talk with Norman Otis Richmond about Black Music Month. Apparently, President Obama has had a change of plans. It altered the language of the Black Music Identification. So we're going to have Norman has written a piece about this, an open letter to President Barack Hussein Obama. we'll talk to him about that. And after that, we're going to talk about the Quebec students and the community that is giving them broad support, trade unions, lawyers, politicians, and, of course, all around the world. There's a keen interest in the amazing demonstrations that have taken place in Quebec, and it is a very interesting workplace where new ideas are being put forward, and certainly great skill is being shown by student organizers and others. We'll talk to Robin Philpott in Montreal about that. And at the halfway point, we'll probably be speaking to Toronto lawyer David Jacobs, who has practiced before various international tribunals. We're going to focus on the Charles Taylor case, which has just reached a phase where they've given the a decision that's been reached, and Charles Taylor has been found guilty of various offenses. We'll ask David Jacobs to detail them and explain their weight, significance, and of course, the editorials have begun to pour out about what great lessons and how we're all going to learn from this. And I had one question, for example, I will put to David Jacobs later, which is the Toronto Globe and Mail went to great pains to talk about how now you have to be very careful if you're an arms dealer, because if you're shipping weapons and those weapons are used to commit heinous offenses or crimes, you can be punished. So I'd like to call on the Globe and Mail. And of course, the legal authority they were speaking to, James Stewart, who's from this city and who was once a prosecutor, to immediately look into the crimes that are being committed by armed militias in Syria. And the weapons are, according to the people sending them, the weapons are coming from the absolute monarchs of Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And the way we know that is they say that. And people are being murdered, being kidnapped, and every other offense being committed against them. So that might be a place that Mr. Stewart and all these people who are preaching might want to go and have a look. Otherwise, I say they're a bunch of liars. Anyway, we have Otis Richmond on the line. Are you there, Norman?
Yes, sir. How are you?
Good. Hey, thanks a lot for joining us. I was shocked. You've written an open letter to President Barack Hussein Obama.
Yes, sir.
And titled What About We People Who Are Darker Than Blue? And it touches on a really important matter in North American world culture, which is the fact that we have had June as Black Music Month. But President Obama has made some changes? What?
Oh, well, in 79, supposedly Jimmy Carter, I'm still not clear on this, but a group of people went to the White House and June was proclaimed Black Music Month by Jimmy Carter after Max Roach, Dizzy Gillespie, and I think Charles Mingus was in the audience. And, you know, they had Mr. Carter sing Salt Peanuts. And after
well,
that...
He asked to do it, didn't he?
Right. And
Carter is shameless.
And after that, he proclaimed June Black Music Month. And then there were some discrepancies as to whether or not he actually did it. But in 2009, after President Obama was elected, he flipped the script and called it African-American Appreciation Month. And I think the original vision of Black Music Month was, you know, black music is not only made in America, but I think the people that came up with the concept of Black Music Month, Kenneth Gamble and Ed Wright, mm-hmm. realize that black music is not you know, it just didn't jump off of, didn't come out of a watermelon patch in Louisiana or Alabama, but, you know, it came through Africa, through the Caribbean, and it was also influenced by other musics as well. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of black musicians listen to music from India, all over the world.
Yeah. But, by the way, well, you have a great quote here from, I like the, this is appropriately royal, Sir Duke Ellington pointed out, now there's a man, by the way, who earned his title. We have a bunch of dukes running around with no talent, but this was the duke who had talent. Duke Ellington pointed out nearly a century ago that as we people must call, that we must call our music Negro, black music, so others could not dishonestly claim it as theirs, Black music is one of the many gifts that Africa and Africans have presented to the world. You know, that focus on that, I mean, I'm really glad you emphasized it, because you're talking about business now. And when people do this thing of borrowing, not only do they borrow the music, they also take a lot of the money, right?
Well, this whole concept of world music and urban music is, you know, you could get a situation where the greatest urban music person in the world is maybe Adele. I think Adele may be she's from someplace in Europe, Scotland, but I hear people, including my sister, raving about her. But maybe she's that good. But, you know, there's somebody in a church in Jane and Finch probably that can sing circles around Adele. But because the system is set up in such a way that they would give the European the play as opposed to the black person. I mean, and it started that way from Benny Goodman became the king Paul Whiteman was the king of jazz. Benny Goodman was the king of swing. Elvis was the king of rock and roll.
Yep.
Sting, he got a Grammy for reggae before Bob Marley. You know, it's just, I could go on and on and on. Eminem, and I think, by the way, Eminem is a great artist, but I don't think he is the greatest hip-hop artist. Mm-hmm. You always give the imitator, and it's the system, not the people. It's it's the media that creates, gives the imitator, makes them the innovator, and gives them the play, which makes it possible for them to earn more money than the person who started the ball to roll.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we're speaking to Norman Otis Richmond, and he's on Saturday mornings, Saturday at RadioRegent.com from 10 to 1, and Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio every Sunday, 2 to 4 p.m. That's UhuruRadio.com. Norman, you've spoken up, and I bet there must be other voices about this idea of moving from talking about music to talking about just appreciation of a sort of a broad identity.
There are people. There's a group in London, in England, that are doing something. I just found a group in Arkansas that's doing things. They're all over the United States. Black is a bad word now, you know. We are, you know, since the election of Obama, it's become fashionable to be biracial, which is, I'm not knocking biracial, because I guess all of us are really biracial when you get right down to it.
Or not racial.
Yeah.
If we have, the anthropologists get very frustrated with all of us with our color schemes. I guess the emphasis should be on the word scheme.
But I think that the whole question of, I'm predominantly black, and I'm not ashamed of being black or African. I use both of those. And I think that, it's not just like I say in my letter, that black people have contributed more than just music, but gifts. Music is just one of our gifts to the world. And I think that, since, 1873, when the Fifth Jubilee Singers went all over Europe, and they knocked the socks off of people's all over the world. I mean, all over Europe. Then you had the jazz people went to all over the world, and Duke Ellington included. Calypso, you know, Belafonte, when he did his record. Mm-hmm. Calypso, that was the first million-selling album that I know about. Then, of course, you had the reggae people. And then Otis Redding and dethroned Elvis Presley in 1967. Melody Maker made him the greatest, said he was the greatest singer at that particular point. And everyone knows that the art form that they call hip-hop is ruling the world at this particular point. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that black music is the only music, but black yeah. music has been the most popular music and the most influential music around the world.
I think that's indisputable. I mean, by the way, when the U.S. was interested in trying to, you know, during the Cold War, promoting its image, they always sent Louis Armstrong.
Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie.
And I remember they had that the musical about the New Orleans situation. I forget the name of the musical, but they toured the world.
St. Louis Blues, was it St. Louis Blues, maybe? Or was it
Phil Conley
John
knows.
Anti Mame.
Something like that?
Anti Mame.
Oh, he thinks it's Annie Mae. Actually, well, now we've got a debate. No, it's not Annie Mae. I'm sorry, I raised it. But it is a fact that the U.S. itself relies, it's Porgy and Bess.
Porgy and Bess, yeah, that's...
I win my own prize. How about that? I guess I shan't pick that up.
So that's Dorothy Dandridge, yeah.
But they relied on black performers to present, and they said, you want to see the face of America? I remember a professor telling our class, he says, the only cultural contribution our country has made to the world is black music. And I remember we all thought, gosh, I better go home. I'm ashamed.
Well, I'll give you a joke one time. Louis Armstrong gets a lot of, he gets a lot of slack for being this head-scratching Uncle Tom. He was far from that. There was a story.
Very far, yes.
There was a story, and I've heard this from many, many sources, that Louis Armstrong was known to have consumed quite a bit of Mary Jane, mm-hmm. ganja, tampi, they called it in Trinidad.
Before the president.
Yeah, and he was supposed to have been coming off of a plane, and he ran into Nixon, who at that time was Senator Nixon, and Senator Nixon asked Mr. Armstrong, "Well, Mr. Armstrong, is there anything I can do for you?" And Louis Armstrong at that time was probably had a kilo of marijuana in his bag. So, yes, Senator Nixon, could you just carry this through customs for me, you know? But it is true that Satchmo was given diplomatic immunity. He didn't have to go through customs mm-hmm. because after what happened took place in, I think, Birmingham, what was taking place in the South, he protested that, you know, he... Frank Sinatra could go all over the world and not be searched, so he demanded that he, I guess since he was doing all those tours for the State Department, then just let me go do my thing and leave me alone. So he did a little Bob Marley. He smoked a little Bob Marley, right?
It's by the way, on the point about his not being as people saw him on stage, they did, you know, collect all of his recordings. He recorded himself around the house. They say that they're really hard to expose what he was saying to any. They're there, but he was very frank about what he thought about the world, and he particularly hated the folks who were running the operation in New Orleans.
Oh yeah, he was
because that whole city owed him a tremendous amount, and they treated him very badly.
He considered himself. He said he was from the Gold Coast. And, he went to Ghana before Ghana was independent, and I think Ghana became independent in March 6, 1957. And in 56, before they were independent, you know, he went to the Gold Coast and performed for Nkrumah, even before when they were still the Gold Coast.
And he had a rough idea who Nkrumah was, too.
Oh, yeah. Nkrumah invited him.
Yeah. We're speaking to Norman Otis Richmond, and Norman, I want to just point out that... you raise this issue. They're changing from Black Music Month to African American Appreciation, which is, by the way, a huge jump. And when the subject of the Black Music Month came up, judging from your open letter, the members of the administration claimed they really weren't aware of Black Music Month. But you said June 2009, it was the cover of Ebony Magazine.
Yes, it was.
Somebody at the White House must be aware of Ebony Magazine, aren't they?
I think that Obama, from the last time I checked, he lived quite a few years in Chicago, and I think Michelle Obama, she may have been born in South Carolina, but I think she spent the majority of her life in Chicago, and, I think that...
Ebony was a major, it still has to be a major publication.
Ebony's published in Chicago, right?
Yeah.
And the editor of Ebony Magazine, John E. Johnson, in 1957, was in Ghana with... he was invited to Ghana by Nkrumah, and there's pictures of...
Maybe that's what they don't want to be reminded by.
Yeah. Mr. Johnson, he knows about it. Because, I mean, growing up, and you grew up in the United States, but when I grew up in the United States, we read Ebony Magazine was, not Ebony, yeah. but Ebony is a sort of a middle class, but the Jet Magazine was like the Bible.
Yeah.
That's how we read about what was taking place in music and sports and politics. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And so I don't think I think President Obama is he knows music. I mean, he just invited Bob Dylan was in the White House the other day, and he just went to Israel.
Him and Madeleine Albright. What an awful! That must have been a culturally awkward moment.
And last year he invited Paul McCartney to do in June. You know, Paul McCartney's.
Well, that means your invitation is in the mail.
Maybe my invitation to, maybe he'll send a drone after me, too.
This is Norman Otis Richmond, and he's written an open letter to President Barack Hussein Obama. What about we people who are darker than blue? Norman, let me suggest something. How about sending your letter? Make sure that goes to Ebony and what's the other publication? I'm forgetting the name of it.
Jet. Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
They're the ones who ought to make sure that thing goes in there. Anyway, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye. That's Norman Otis Richmond, the man with a lot of names. That call was just to remind me that we have other people. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm here with Phil Taylor with Phil Conlon. Hey, Phil, by the way, we have a... there's an event going on at Beth Satoon, right?
Yes, there is. I love
saying that.
It's part of a worldwide tour that's coming to Toronto this Thursday, and it'll run through June 24th. And it's an exhibition called A Child's View from Gaza. It's a collection of drawings depicting the realities of daily life in Gaza under siege, and it's 26 drawings created by children. And that's going to their opening reception is this Thursday at 6 p.m. at Beth Satoon, 612 Markham Street. And then the exhibit will run through the 24th. And on the 14th, which is a week Thursday, Eva Bartlett will be appearing. And she is a personal witness to
Eva Bartlett has worked in Gaza, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Not just like a tourist. She's spent a lot of time.
She worked there, right, yeah.
And incidentally, Hillary Clinton seems to be concerned about the use of weapons and violence against civilians and in the region, and so again, the Israeli Air Force over the weekend did one of their flybys and blasted the place. So if they really want to get excited at the United Nations and have a big heavy meeting about use of disproportionate force, I'd suggest they look into the Israeli Air Force, who by the way has a comedian named Sasha Cohen. He's got what's that movie called Dictator. I think he gets all these jokes from the Israeli Air Force. Anyway, I think we are joined now by Robin Philpott. Are you there, Robin?
Hello, Phil.
Hey, thanks a lot for joining us. You live in Montreal. You've written about so many aspects of Quebec culture, a number of books which are very widely read.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you acknowledge that you've participated in some of these demonstrations. Tell us, first of all, why did you decide to join the in support of the students?
Well, I mean, it's something that I can proudly say that we've been, and my wife and I and several others have been to a lot of demonstrations, not every night, but almost. When we started getting, just by their getting involved, because they were so many people among our friends and stuff whose kids are at these colleges or universities. And we also saw what the nature of this movement, and that it was not going to go away. It was something that where they were going much beyond the tuition fees, although the tuition fees and the resulted indebtedness mm-hmm. are at the heart of the thing. It's going much further, and it's like people are tired of the business as usual approach to this, approach to politics mm-hmm. and approach to the economy, and mm-hmm. that you know there's been a steady worsening of people's economic conditions. So anyway, we've been involved in a lot of these demonstrations.
Well, I've seen on the net, but not in our major media here, mm-hmm. photographs of lawyers in their robes with the most popular symbol, the red squares.
Sure.
Protesting this law. And I notice here when they report on it, the press always makes a point, Globe Star, others, putting quotes around words like draconian. They say, well, they call it draconian or excessive. The lawyers seem to be convinced that this is something quite out of the ordinary, reminiscent of the war measures in terms of the concept.
Yeah, it's not as it is not as drastic as the War Measures Act, but it's in the same spirit as the War Measures Act. It's aimed at applying collective responsibility on individuals. It's aimed on
very heavy fines, for example, for all kinds of behavior.
Yeah, very heavy fines. In other words, somebody can say, "Well, we have to go and demonstrate," and then he can be arrested because he's calling to go to a demonstration where there has been no itinerary has been provided, and so on. And so this march, which seemed counterintuitive, you know, most lawyers are often perceived as being, working for big companies and so on, or charging a lot of money. Maybe they do, but there were more than 500 lawyers marching in Montreal from the courthouse down to the square, which is called Place Émilie Gamelin, and mm-hmm. where all the demonstrations generally start from, and 500 wearing their robes.
500.
Yeah, and then there were notaries as well, and which. It was that picture went around the world, but I don't think it went into Toronto as
not
much.
Not to Toronto. No, Toronto Star, I think yesterday, had a picture of a young man wearing toilet plungers on the side of his head. And I think they thought that this is important to convey to the readers of Toronto Star the type of people.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Just to give you
not 500 lawyers. That might, kind of hard to do that with.
Yeah, it was Saturday. It was a heavy rain, cold, and there were, between 10 and 20,000 marchers. The media reported on a few thousand. The media here, I don't know whether it was reported in Toronto, but somebody just sent me something that came out of the Corsican media, and there are a lot of international
Corsican?
Media here. Yeah, somebody from Corsica.
The home of Napoleon?
Yeah, right, and it was a Corsica news report, and there are people from Switzerland, France, Italy, covering these events, these demonstrations, and they reported there were between 10,000 and 20,000 people. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you can see how there's this control of information that makes it so that you get the feeling they don't want people to know how profound. Mm-hmm. This movement is, and it is striking, and so far it's been extremely creative. You know, there was a period in May where it was getting every night there would be a confrontation. We're on the 41st night in a row where there's a demonstration. It starts out 41 nights in a row. At 8 o'clock, 8:30, it starts out at this place called Place Émilie Gamelin, which is right at the main hub, main metro hub, subway hub. And these demonstrations were headed out, and they would start out. They were anything from 500 to 15,000 people. But it's every night there have been demonstrations. And this has been going on. But there was a period in May up until about the
20th. It sounds like a distinct society.
Yeah, well, there is.
Or perhaps a nation.
Yeah, no, it's one of these.
I forgot. We can't
French
say that.
A journalist asked me, what is this an expression of Quebec's distinctness? And they said, and what is Quebec distinctness? And this was at this huge demonstration where there were, people are talking about 250,000. This was on the 22nd of May. And I said, well, this is unseen. You know, 250,000 people in Montreal is out of a population of 8 million in Quebec is the equivalent of a 10 million man march, person march in Washington. I mean, if proportionally. So, but I just want to say about you know, there, and there was confrontations with cops every night for various reasons. And the cops were provoking. I saw them. You know, fortunately, I never got arrested or anything or got hit. But people I know well were seriously injured by the police. And they were just demonstrators. They were not wearing any mask or anything. Mm-hmm. And so and that was when the law was adopted. Mm-hmm. Well, right after the law was adopted, the whole pots and pans phenomena took hold and spread like wildfire across the city and across Quebec. Mm-hmm. And it's something which I think it disarmed the police.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way that the police, this creativity is wonderful because it's been a way of maintaining, of broadening the movement, because you can't keep fighting the cops every day. You know, it's like a certain point. At one night, for instance, just after the...
No, sometimes you must rest. Fighting cops.
Yeah. And, well, they arrested 600 people here in Montreal, another 100 people in Quebec City on the 24th of May, which is the 2 days after this huge demonstration. No, the 23rd, sorry. It was the day after the huge demonstration. You know, 500 or 600. Well, now, since the 23rd of May, there have been virtually no arrests. Now, the demonstrations have kept going.
Mm-hmm.
Last night there was
somebody's philosophy has changed,
and that's a political decision. I think
yes.
They probably may have said, "Boy, you know, we're getting all these media here; they're going to think we're other place in the world, so we better hold back." And so, the police and let me just describe the way these demonstrations work: is people start gathering at this square with their pots and pans, and they're locking it. Now the cops come along at 8:30 and say this demonstration is illegal, and that's this departure signal. That's when people go demonstrating, and so the cops tolerate it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's in other words, somehow they realize they.
Yes.
But by
the way, they could also change their plans in a day or two. And
well, which is what we think they're.
We've all seen this in history.
Yeah. No. And the student organizations have said we are in favor of civil disobedience. We are not going to obey this law.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, it has worked, and the pots and pans have been one of the ways of doing it because.
Oh, it's been brilliant! And by the way, I will say that Natalie Davis, I think she's a retired professor from University of Toronto and University of California, if I have the right Natalie Davis, said that again, this is a mark of creativity, and it has had a calming effect.
Yeah.
On the population.
Yeah, and it's a calming and a broadening, because. And people, because then...
Yeah, because the demonstrations go forward.
Exactly. And also you get people who are, you know, they've got small children, they can't get to all these marches. Well, they go and walk around their blocks, you know, and they end up bringing several hundred people with them. And throughout the city and throughout Quebec, I mean, it's happening in Gatineau, it's happening in cities all over the place.
This is going to be like Halloween, you know. The kids next year are going to say, hey, it's time to get the pots and pans out and go wandering through the neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what it is. Now, the big challenge now, they're trying all kinds of fear tactics. You know, the Chamber of Commerce and all these festivals are saying, you know, you're going to
spoil the races.
Yeah, well, there's a Grand Prix this weekend, and then there's the festivals. And, of course, the student leaders have said, we are going to do acts that are done to increase our visibility and make our position known to Quebec and to the world. but we're not out there to disturb the economy. And so they made it clearly, but they keep, you know, trying to say, well, this is so bad for the economy. We heard a lot of people saying, well, it's not true because, you know, I ran into a couple of New York tourists the other day, and they said, well, this is why we come to Montreal. It's the greatest place to visit.
So, the demonstration tourists.
Yeah. No, or they just like the life that is going on here. You know, it's sort of a reflection. It's not when they started pushing, the cops were attacking a lot. Well, then they had these images on TV, which is what I think they wanted. They thought they could break it with that, with doing that, and it hasn't worked.
Well, what about the student leaders? Hasn't one of them, a couple of them, been sort of targeted? If I were to look at the rap sheet on them, I mean, their lawyer would say, you know, you got a big headache here.
Yeah. Well, this young guy, 21-year-old Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois, has been, he's in court, well, it's been put off now to the fall for contempt of court because there was an injunction that some student, this is one student against the others who went and brought the courts in to question because there was a vote at Laval University in favor of a strike. And so they, in order to have this respect the strike mandate, they didn't want people to go in. Mm-hmm. And so the student who felt he was had been so he went to court and got an injunction against injunction allowing him to go to court, and then he went after Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois, who's the leader of the class, for contempt of court, and that's going on. Mm-hmm. The minister of the public security has personally named him, and basically they tried to link any kind of demonstration to vandalism and violence. Mm-hmm. And the Sûreté du Québec, which is Quebec's provincial cops, police, went and didn't arrest him, but they called him in and they grilled him for quite a long time. I don't know how long it lasted. Mm-hmm. About the student movement, what they're doing, and which is totally unacceptable. Yeah. You know, to actually go in and start harassing this guy. It's basically trying to scare him.
There is a kind of, and people have pointed out that the student movement, that class is called, mm-hmm. but you also have a kind of class war. Now, the employers, they got some sort of statement from Quebec employers. I don't know if they published it in the newspapers, reported on here.
Well, it's
backing Charest. I understand the unions backing the students.
Oh, absolutely.
And then we have a dispute over, you know, are we going to implement neo-Reaganism here or neoliberalism, whatever the magic word is.
Yeah.
Charest went to Quebec to teach them the fundamentals of this form of economics.
Right,
but
right.
How is that being reported, and why are the unions jumping in support of the students?
Well, I would say, I mean, they've said this is, first of all, I mean, they basically, they've always stood for an accessible education for everybody. That's, the unions they've taken political positions over the years. And, you know, people forget that during the Quiet Revolution, there was a commission on education in Quebec in the 1960s. It was called the Parent Report. Named after the man by the name of Parent, and they recommended, and these people, that we have free post-secondary education. And they said, we cannot do this today, but we will go towards that. And there's still people who are on that commission who are alive, and they've said, what the students are asking for is what we were standing for in the 1960s.
Good.
So it's not something.
Well, the employers can say from their side they didn't believe in that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
But I mean, people. This was consensus at that time in what we call what we have called as the Quiet Revolution. Well, now people are just saying, well, listen, this was right. It wasn't wrong to go for that. And so the unions, they have a sense of history as well. They're aware of this, and they've stood behind this. And I stood behind them, and then there's the question of your right to association, because this law could eventually attack the teachers' union as well. because it says
we left them out. That's true. The teachers have been supportive.
True. The teachers have been very supportive. They were meeting with the minister today because they said, okay, you passed a law which says we have to compress the school year into so many, or the session into so many months. Well, how are we going to do that? You know, and
they also have contracts. And,
sure, they have contracts
and agreements.
Say,
yes.
Yeah, and so you mentioned the employers association. They've been very bad on this thing. But last week, and I there was this video came out anonymous. You know, the organization managed to get its hands on a video that on a party being that was held in a place up in northern Quebec. Well, northeastern Quebec, it's called Sagar, and it's a chateau. It's out of the, you know, Louis the 14th period, you know, something out of the 18th century. And it's owned by this family, Desmarais. Desmarais are the owners of Power Corporation. Mm-hmm. They own Investors Group, Great West Life, Canada Life, London Life, and many other companies.
And La Presse?
La Presse, of course. They also control the oil company Total, which is out in the west coast, out in Alberta. And so they had this party in 2008 for Desmarais had it for his wife. And who was there? George Bush Sr., Ryan Mulroney, Jean Chrétien, Lucien Bouchard, and Jean Charest, and a bunch of big businessmen. And it's a two-hour-long video, which they never thought would become public.
It is brilliant. It is beautiful.
Yeah. It is something out of... It is the 1%. Yeah. It's, like, say, it's Quebec and Canada's, because it's Canada as well. These are...
The beauty of it is there's none of the 99% visible.
No.
I don't even see anybody going by with a tray. It's only the real people.
Yeah.
Yes.
And they're wearing their Orders of Canada, and it's just something.
So people can go, and how would they find it? If I was looking that up, how would
if they look up Desmarais, Desmarais, and Jean Charest party, you just do that on Google, you'll find it. I tested it. If you write Desmarais party, Charest, you'll find it. So it's there are other videos that I recommend. I think you've seen a few of them. You're telling me that there's one on the whole pots and pans movement, which
with music, yes, that's gone. That has really gone around the world. I've had relatives send me that from parts of the literally the globe.
Yeah,
people say, "Have you seen this?
Yeah,
are you in Canada? Did you do this?"
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. People are thrilled. So you can see how artists, when they're involved, how great they can, how much they can help a movement.
Yeah, it's very dangerous for the powerful to cross an artist. Funny things happen. Yes.
Yeah.
It's kind of like playing with a magician. You will lose your wallet.
Yeah, and what has happened is there have been a lot of artists, singers, writers who've gotten involved, very much involved, and it's really stirred things up. And what you've had is, you know, you really have people are divided on left and right, and of course, the question of the future of Quebec is in there very much. Mm-hmm. You know, where is Quebec going to go?
Yes.
But you even have some sort of more opportunist people who've been sovereigntists who are showing their real class lines. I mean, Lucien Bouchard, who is in there with Desmarais.
Yes. Well, he left the camp a long time ago, right?
He left a long time ago, and he was the guy who allowed Desmarais to get control of the Daily in Quebec City as well, which even Bourassa would not allow. Bourassa stepped in and said, there's no way that we can allow this.
Well, you know, here, I mean, the Star and the Globe always hated Bourassa. They said, he says he's a federalist, but we don't trust him, so we, you know, keep an eye on him.
Yeah. But Charest is their man.
Great chapter.
And there's one thing people should remember is that Charest earned his stripes in their eyes, in the eyes of the Desmarais and the wealthy elite in Canada and throughout Quebec, in 95. And in 98, they were the ones who requisitioned him for to become head of the Liberal Party. And even the editorialist of La Presse, which is a Desmarais newspaper, wrote in his biography of Charest, he put it in the conditional to protect himself, but he says the word has it that that Desmarais was involved, and they gave him they promised him a large amount of money. They called it a golden bridge, which was going to be could use for his kids to go to a private school, and for him to have a very wealthy home up in Westmount. And this is the editorialist from La Presse who wrote, but he put it in the conditional. But it is well known that Charest was requisitioned to come here to put Quebec in its place.
Yes.
So what he's doing now is its first, I would
failing
say,
in
its
that
first
effort.
Real test. sorry, what?
I said he's failing in that effort.
Well, or else he's trying to deliver it.
He's certainly trying to deliver, yes.
This is his toughest test, I would say, since he got that job. Yeah. Because it's, up until now, there's been so much division in Quebec and various political reasons, for various political reasons, and now he's being tested.
Yeah. So. Well, thank you, Robin. You've covered the whole waterfront. We really appreciate it.
Great.
We're all going to go look for that video. Thanks very much.
Yeah, and then put on your Red Square.
Oh, yes, of course.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Then. Bye. Yeah,
bye-bye. That was Robin Philpott, and he's written a lot about it. You can Google Robin, and you'll find an awful lot of stuff. I'll just tell you quickly, there's going to be June 5th, that's tomorrow, 8 p.m., King Street East and George Street, and it says, wear as much red as possible. Students and workers unite to support in solidarity with Quebec students. No more debt. This is Taylor Report. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
From the roots up. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
And we are back, just like I said. It's Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. You can write to us, Taylor, at CIUT.FM, and you can check us out, Taylor-Report.com, where these interviews such as those we're conducting today are available. And Phil, there's another announcement, a poet.
Yes. One of Toronto's truly great people's poets, Rob Rolfe, will be reading on Tuesday, June the 12th, that's a week from tomorrow, at the St. Clair Silverthorn Library, 1748 St. Clair West. It's the St. Clair Kick-It Festival, and Rob, who was a longtime resident of St. Clair until very recently, where he relocated to Owen Sound, will be coming back to his old haunts to do a reading. So that's at the St. Clair Silverthorn Library, 1748 St. Clair Avenue West, Tuesday the 12th, from 7 to 8:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to be announcing, there's a new book, by the way, Milton Acorn, in a Springtime Instant, and spring has been a big word here lately. Springtime Instant, Selected Poems, edited by James Deal. On July the 12th, there's going to be a book launch, and we'll be talking about that a little bit later on. I just want to alert you in advance that is coming up in July at the launch of the book of Milton Acorn, Selected Poems, edited by James Deal, and it's published by Mosaic Press. We're joined, I think, by David Jacobs. Are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
Hey, thanks very much. We're a little later than we thought, but we're glad to be talking to you. The Charles Taylor decision has come down, and it's been followed by a flood of editorials, all rather predictable, I guess, saying, well, this shows it. Here's a head of state. He's been brought to the book, and this will bring in, shows it, it proves that there's no more impunity for powerful people who are committed of crimes against humanity in an international court. You've read this and followed it. And, matter of fact, I know you're aware that there was a judge who was sitting there who disagreed with the other judges. What's your reaction to the Taylor decision and the comments that are flowing from it?
The comments are really kind of shocking. I mean, there's been a series of triumphal articles in the paper and news reports on everything from CNN to the BBC, Fox News, all of which are indistinguishable about this. The Globe ran a front page story and an editorial, and then subsequently an opinion piece by Erna Paris, all applauding tremendously that here we have the end of impunity. I mean, in one sense, it's a little strange because that's what commentators who are on this side of the that side of the debate have suggested, that the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda and the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, they all ended impunity. So it's odd that we still have impunity, but it ended all over again.
You
keep having to end impunity. Mm-hmm. So one of the big problems, I think, and the papers sort of relegated to the small print, if they do at all, is that he actually wasn't found guilty of many of the things that the prosecutor tried to find him guilty of, such as being in command, having command responsibility.
They said no.
They found that he was aiding and abetting, which is a kind of unusual thing, and it's based on the fact that allegedly he assisted to fund one of the sides in the war in Sierra Leone. But he and his lawyer made an absolutely excellent point about this, that if he is in the dock charged with aiding and abetting one side, and everybody seems to agree that atrocities are committed on all sides, this is what the court said, the special court has said.
Well, they definitely agreed to that.
Yes.
Because
he says, and his lawyer, Cordy Griffiths, said, I'll read from the transcript here, it was notorious at the time in 1998 and 1999, atrocities were perpetrated on all sides. Now, this emerges from the case law of the special court as well as the report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So what are we to make of those who supported the other side in the conflict? For example, Tony Blair in the United Kingdom provided assistance and support to the pro-government forces. The pro-government forces had their own sinister militia involved in rapes, recruitment of child soldiers, amputations, cannibalism, and other atrocities.
Cannibalism, yes.
So there is a...
Charged Tony Blair.
Yeah, so there's an issue of, you know, the end of impunity apparently only applies to people who are triable. And the people who are triable appear to be those people who've gotten on the wrong side of the United States and Britain and the European powers, and those people who are in fact defeated, and who are, you know, themselves, their country, subject to regime change. Nobody seriously takes the idea that Tony Blair or George Bush or Bill Clinton, or for that matter, Barack Obama or Stephen Harper, and the list goes on, Sarkozy, are ever going to be brought to book for war crimes they've committed. You know,
well, by the way, let's pick one out. Sarkozy and Obama, Libya, they supplied weapons, and indeed they even fired their own weapons on behalf of a cause where people, and particularly African people in Libya, were brutalized and murdered and raped and hanged and quartered, etc. And as a matter of fact, it's ongoing. So you can immediately, those who believe impunity is passed, should go and put the cuffs on Sarkozy and Obama.
Yes, I mean, absolutely, of course, and that's those are the issues that have been raised again by Courtney Griffiths and by Charles Taylor in his speech to the court, which is available on the internet. It's well worth reading. I mean, Charles Taylor makes a number of very powerful points about an executive order coming down from the Bush administration, which determined that regime change was needed in Liberia and so on.
Yes, and by the way, but in this court never admits it, the role that as being what it was about. They say, oh, no, it's about him and Sierra Leone, but it's on the record. George Bush wanted to remove Charles Taylor from Liberia, not Sierra Leone.
Well, here's the public record. Again, if your listeners won't mind listening to a bit of reading from the text, he says, when regime change in Liberia, this is Charles Taylor's speech to the court on the 16th of May of this year, when regime change in Liberia became a policy of the United States government, President George W. Bush, in May of 2001, signed the second of two executive orders, number 13213, in which it was stated, and I quote, the government of Liberia's complicity in illicit trade in diamonds and so on. So these actions by the government of Liberia contribute to the unusual and extraordinary threat to the foreign policy of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So Taylor says, Charles Taylor says, this executive order didn't say alleged complicity. It concluded the complicity. The conspiracy was born, all systems put into motion, and here I stand today. I never stood a chance. This is a broader contextual matrix that regrettably did not and still has not seen the light of day in these proceedings, despite the gallant efforts by defense to unearth and reveal the contextual framework.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned at the outset, and I suppose it's worth mentioning now, that amid all the huzzas about the verdict and the cloudy representations of the verdict, given that the verdict, again, found him guilty of aiding and abetting rather than command responsibility, is the extraordinary dissent from a well-respected judge on the special court for Sierra Leone, Justice So. And not only is his dissent extraordinary, but the almost abject wall-to-wall failure of Western media to report it, and frankly, if your your listeners can prove me wrong on that, I'd be very interested.
Nobody's reported it. This
is a majority judgment.
But that's CIUT, and you know.
But and you can find this on a website called International.
Actually, I find it on the Taylor-Report site.
Oh, it's on the Taylor Report.
Yeah. We thought we should share that.
There you go. Well, I'm glad you did.
We didn't think there was any drones in the neighborhood, so we put it up.
But somebody called Kirsty Sutherland, who's in the court, reported the dissent of Justice So, who was an alternate judge in the proceeding. And if you don't mind, if you have time, I can read a little bit of it.
Go ahead.
He says, pursuant to the rules, when there are no serious deliberations, the only place left for me is a courtroom. I have my dissenting opinion, and I disagree with the findings and conclusions of the other judges, because for me, under any mode of liability, under any accepted standard of proof, the guilt of the accused from the evidence provided in this trial is not proved beyond reasonable doubt by the prosecution. And my only worry is that the whole system is not consistent with all the principles we know and love, and the system is not consistent with all the values of international criminal justice, and I'm afraid the whole system is under grave danger of just losing all credibility, and I'm afraid this whole thing is headed for failure. So Justice So, again, a well-respected judge, who I believe is now working for the United Nations, comes out with this absolutely extraordinary dissent. One has to assume that he does it in full knowledge of its gravity and what he's saying about the court. When he got up to say his dissent, to give his speech, the other justices walked out, and his microphone was turned off, and the curtains to the public gallery were closed. So I recall,
curtains at a show trial? That's extraordinary.
So I recall your saying, I think, and I listened to your show a few weeks ago, I think you had Christopher Black on, and he was discussing this just sort of virtually as it was happening. And I think, Phil, you said that, I guess he's not going to sit as a judge anymore. So now we know that because on the 16th of May, the three judges gave the verdict of the plenary of the judges of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. They said that those three judges who sat on the Taylor trial recused themselves from the plenary on this, but read the verdict, which is that they declared Justice Malik So's behavior in court amounted to misconduct, rendering him unfit to sit as an alternate judge of the special court. And they directed him to refrain from further sitting in proceedings.
They passed judgment on the judge.
They judged the judge.
And by the way, that Erna Paris piece in the Globe had this strange comment. It said, well, it was judges from all over the world. Well, Judge Lussick is from Australia. The number two judge, another judge, was from Northern Ireland. And then there was a judge from Uganda. So it's two Europeans and one African. And then the alternate judge was an African, and he ended up disciplined.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
By the one from Australia, which is, as we know, the most representative, broadly cultural mixed country in the world. And well, outloves Canada towards the United States. There's a deadly competition between Canada and the U.S.
Well, the Australian judge read the decision, but was kind of careful to...
By the way, how about the prosecutors? Tell us who was prosecuting.
Well, according to Charles Taylor, and let me...
And by the way, I'm going to swear... I've checked the record. He's absolutely accurate as to who the prosecutors were.
Let me get to it. He talks about the prosecution team.
Well, I have my notes. If I could help out here.
I was going to read more from the text, but go ahead.
I just want to make sure I mention their names. One is Mr. Crane, a Lieutenant Colonel, United States Air Force. Another is James Johnson, a 20 years expert on conventional and special operations for the United States Army, and Alan White, 30 years of. Air Force intelligence. These are the prosecutors, and of course, there's the woman, Colonel Hollis. She never gets called Colonel Hollis while doing the prosecution, but Hollis, who is quote gets interviewed, is a lieutenant colonel in the United States Air Force. That's the prosecution team.
Right, and then what's his name? Charles Taylor also says she's with Defense Intelligence, CIA, also mentions Stephen Rapp, who came on board as chief prosecutor for a short time. His experience was serving with the U.S. Senate Judiciary Subcommittee.
So he's prosecuted almost exclusively in an international tribunal by Americans, three-quarters of whom are U.S. military.
So it definitely would appear.
Now, how do you go about getting an international court of that configuration? I mean, I would like to be at the hiring hall for that show.
Well, Charles Taylor's point, of course, is that this fits the contextual background of an executive order by the U.S. government condemning Liberia and seeking regime change. And, frankly, it doesn't really enhance respect for international justice to have the prosecution team formatted like this against an African person being tried, as I understand it, there in Europe.
Yes. Isn't that extraordinary? David Jacobs, we really appreciate it. You've, of course, been before all these courts, and I bet you're not a bit surprised.
Well, I don't know whether it's an appropriate analogy, but it very much reminds me of, I wasn't there at the time, but when Julius Caesar conquered Gaul, he brought back the Gaulish leader and let him lie in jail for a while and then just publicly executed him. It's what you do with regime change.
Yeah. Well, that's a morbid comment. Thank you very much. It is appropriate.
Okay.
David Jacobs, thank you very, very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. David Jacobs, and this is the Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM. And I just want to make one last, we have about a minute ago, and say that for those who are celebrating the Taylor case, please remember that a senator in Liberia, the one who told his supporters to support Johnson Sirleaf so she could become president in a divided election, he gave his support to her. Prince Johnson is famous for cutting the ears off Charles Doe, and it's on video. People see it. He had him tortured to death while he watched and drank a beer. He also, according to a recent British paper, said that a Red Cross employee got in trouble with him, and Prince Johnson publicly executed him, shot him with an AK-47. He is a senator in Liberia. And he guaranteed the election of Sirleaf Johnson, or whatever she's called. So, impunity in Liberia, please. This is just a terrible, morbid, sick joke. You've been listening to Taylor Report, and I want to thank Carol and Phil, and we'll see you next week.